I really am. The reason I'm late is because I was down at the Boston Pizza drinking wine. So I'm just sorry about that. I thought it was 8 o'clock. I forgot to mention that too. I thought it was 8 o'clock and I thought I'd written down 7:30 so I could be early because I usually put, you know, 15 minutes before I'm supposed to be anywhere, but this time I didn't. Why are we, I suppose you've been coming here for weeks. I haven't. Why are we coming here? Why are we gathered here? And especially on such a terribly, terribly cold night. And the reason we are is that whether we like it or not, whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable, whether we're taking an awful lot of hassle about it or not, we're all caught up in something that every day we stay with it, every week that passes, every month of our lives becomes more and more part of the very, very marrow of our being. And that is this continuing and deepening struggle, this awful struggle that we're engaged in for the equality of women. And the question, yes, do you have something to say? Go say it and then, Well, if you don't like it, you've got two legs, I presume you're not paralytic, you can leave, the door is at the back to the right. And furthermore, I am not impressed by slovenly manners. The question that I want to speak on tonight is one that sooner or later, for those within the movement, we have to really, really think about and finally decide upon. And the question is simply this. Is it the capitalist system that is responsible for the oppression of women? Or to put it another way, listen, if you have all the answers, I would just ask that I be allowed to speak. And then, when you have proven your sincerity and 20 years of feminism, you'd be allowed to speak. Otherwise, kindly leave or shut up. We're going to put the question another way. Would our chances for true equality be greater in a communist, under a communist or under a socialist system than it is under our present system of democracy? I want to approach this question through a look at the present condition and the status of women in China, the degree of their political participation in the Democratic Republic of East Germany and Cuba, and we'll look at prevailing social attitudes in the Soviet Union. And then we'll return to what is at the heart of the matter. Is women's liberation only incidental to a primary class struggle, or is it something that exists on its own? Now, as you may or may not know, I've been in China 2 times. And everywhere I've gone, I've spoken to the women and asked them what they feel is the greatest improvement in their life since the communist takeover. And they told me, almost without exception, that it has been within marriage. Now, this is certainly understandable because it is within the traditional marriage that the tyrant has full authoritarian sway and, of course, always aided and abetted by the judiciary and the legislature. Marriages were arranged, child marriages were common, as was the practice of selling infant girls into concubinage. Wife beating was normal within marriage, as it still is with our Earth throughout the world, and Vancouver, of course, is no exception to this, as any judge or lawyer who works in the family court will acknowledge. In China, the wealthy woman had certain property rights, and through that property had a proportionate status and power. This, of course, is the whole key to equality, economic equality. But the Chinese woman could not divorce, no matter how intolerable the abuses within that marriage. And this inability to ultimately protect herself by the divorce was something she shared with the very poorest Chinese peasant. Until 20 years ago, China also had the lowest per capita income in the world, even lower than that of India. And the burden of this poverty, as it does in all societies, falls upon the woman more than the man. He suffers perhaps intolerable working conditions, just as she does. But even if she does suffer these conditions, working in a factory, etc., she returns to the home at night, and it is her responsibility, the mother and the wife's responsibility, to make up for all the economic and psychological failures of the system, to bridge the gap between the week-to-week subsistence, to bolster spirits and ego, to nurse the sick, and try and make that slum room, that small hut, habitable, and all the while to bear and cater with the moods and frustrations of her similarly impoverished but socially superior spouse. I discussed these questions with the women of China and asked them how things had changed. They immediately spoke of marriage and the fact that wife beating was no longer tolerated. This obviously meant a great deal to them. Furthermore, a woman can now divorce for good cause, for infidelity, gross incompatibility, and assault. But divorce is considered undesirable, a failure now that marriages are no longer arranged. Women take their choice of partners seriously and feel if it doesn't work out, they have only themselves to blame. All couples considering divorce must take their case before a reconciliation committee, which tries to bring the couple together. However, as the courts of China have not yet reconvened, these matters are now handled by the women's associations. And I'll digress for a moment and tell you the story of one of these incidences where the man returned after being sent to Canton from his Kwantung commune to learn brickmaking. And when he came back, he wanted a divorce. The wife did not want to divorce him. They had four children, and she still kind of liked him, so he became quite abusive. He started talking about her personal appearance, talking about the housework, and finally he beat her. And at this point, the wife went to the Women's Association, where they gathered together and met with him and told him he had to read Mao's essay, the famous essay, Contradictions Amongst the People. They told me that he had studied this, he still couldn't understand it, still wanted a divorce, kept studying it, they kept hounding him, and finally he came back and said now he had a complete political understanding, he didn't want a divorce. Now whether it was that he didn't want a divorce or whether the game wasn't worth a candle, I don't know, but the Women's Association repeated this to me as an example of the fact that if husband and wife do have a clear political understanding, many problems within the marriages are instantly solved. I asked them, well, what does socialist construction have to do with marriage? And they said, quote, to emphasize personal happiness is very bourgeois. Happiness comes when one wholeheartedly dedicates oneself to the state, when the aims of one's life is to build the new China. Difficulties between couples can be resolved if they have a true political understanding in common, end of quote. Well, our reaction, or the reaction of the average Westerner, is perhaps to smile at this, but when we consider the basis of most marriages in Western society, the domestic romantic myth that often sanctions a lifetime of subservient role-playing on both sides, I realize and we showed that our myths are fodder that these women would similarly smile at. Most of the advances that the Chinese women prize, remember that 80% of them live in the rural area, do center on the family and child marriage scene, the child raising and marriage scene. One old woman told me of her experiences when she was 15. She said she'd looked after the cows until she was 15, and her parents called her in one day and told her that they'd found a husband. And a little while later, she said, I left home. My mother had made a new jacket for me, and my brother walked with me to the groom's village. I carried all my goods wrapped in a small cloth. I cried a lot because I was going from a home I knew into one in which I was a stranger. But I didn't feel too unlucky, for I'd seen my future husband, although we had never spoken together. She then spoke of her first child and the terrible labor she had had, and she marveled at the fact the women today who had hard labors received medical treatment. This too is a miracle for the women of China, the small hospital or the clinic that can be found in every administrative area of the commune, a hospital for the sick children, for birth, for the dispensation of contraceptives. All contraceptives that we have available here in the West, except for the foams, I didn't see any foam, are freely available in the current and continuing drive to limit the population. Now we must understand this is not, of course, as we'll deal with later, any feminist conception. It's an economic thing. How successful has this been? It's very difficult to say. And I raise this question and talk about this whole area of reproduction in China because it's a socialized, becoming communized country. And I want to relate it to the psychological status of men and women in such a socialized, communized country. One must assume in a totally controlled country that the government policy of cutting back the population has met with a fair amount of success. But nonetheless, I met a lot of people who had, a lot of women who had more than four or five children, particularly in the rural areas. For instance, I met an officer interviewed a very high-ranking officer of the People's Liberation Army in Peking. And after we finished, he spoke about his wife. And this was a gesture of friendship because they're very jealous about their personal lives. They don't discuss it particularly with Westerners, and particularly with a Western woman. And he spoke of his children, and I asked him how many children he had. And to my total astonishment, because he'd been in the PLA for 25 years, he was 40 years of age, he said four. And I just simply couldn't fit this in because the government's wish to hold the population down is the growth of the population down is very much related to a person's political position and employment. And as I said, this man had been in the PLA for 25 years. Now I puzzled about it and suddenly had an inspiration and asked, did he have mostly girls? Yes, he said he did. He had had three girls and the fourth child was a boy. Keeping the family down to two, the desirable number, is not that all difficult, for the cadres are frequently separated and for long periods from their spouses. That is, the cadres, as you well know, are the highly trained technical worker, interpreter, propagandist of the party, and they are separated for up to a year at a time, for a period of 5 years from their spouses. They get a month off every year to get together. Where they go, whether they're male or female, wherever the state needs them. And they feel, of course, no guilt, no embarrassment of the separation from either their children or their spouse. At least I'm speaking now for the women. In fact, they seem to enjoy the freedom of both being married and being able to pursue a career free of the domestic chores and the child-raising chores that take so much of our psychic energies and physical energies here in the Western world. The children are cared for by grandparents if possible, or by a state nursery if the grandparents aren't available for babysitting. And as I said, the women showed no particular feeling about their children being raised by other people. They assured me, and I had no reason to doubt this, because they're the best cared for kids I've seen anywhere in the world, that they were as loved and as cared for as they themselves could have done it. Now, as far as the ratio of women in high school and university, as you know, the universities have been closed since the Cultural Revolution. They're still in, just when we were there a little earlier this time last year, they're just coming out of the Cultural Revolution. We were able to visit only one of them, and that was Peking University. And the ratio there of men and women students seemed to be pretty balanced. Certainly this is the case in the fields of science and medicine and in engineering. But despite the emergence of women in every occupational level throughout China, they don't quite emerge at the top level. In positions of real power, the fact of the matter is women rarely get near the top. There is only one administrator, Chen Chengying, and she has been Minister of Water, Resources, and Electricity since 1958. And of the 300 full and alternate members of the Central Standing Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, only 23 out of that 300 are women. Of these 23, five were married to the top, to members of the Politburo, the highest level of government in China. Two of these women were Madame Lin Biao and Madame Chen Poda, and whether they've retained these positions since the death of Lin Biao, I very, very much doubt. Now, coming from Canada, where there are only six MPs among 258 males, we really can't criticize this at all. But the fact remains that the government of China has made the equality of women a major issue, something certainly our own government is very far from doing. Yet the overall results are not as different as one would anticipate. One would anticipate perhaps close to 50% representation instead of representation was about 1%, 1.8. If we look at the governments of Cuba and East Germany, we see a similar imbalance at the levels that count, that is at the policy-making level. There are no women at the top level of government in either one of these countries, to the best and latest of my knowledge. Certainly there is no woman in the Politburo of the Russian Soviet. In East Germany, where women comprise 54% of the population, they have a 27% representation in the People's Chamber, which is the highest representational body of the people. Or to put it another way, of the 500 members in the chamber, 363 are men and 137 are women. Furthermore, women comprise only a quarter of college graduates as compared to a little over a third in Canada. Now, I can't give any proven explanation for this unequal degree of participation at policy-making level, but I believe I know the reason, and I know this based not only on my own experiences here and four countries in which I've lived, but also in China, and it's simply that of male chauvinism, which predominates whether the system is capitalist, socialist, or communist. My intuitions in this matter were confirmed on my most recent visit to China when I attempted to find out why equality of the sexes stopped short at the door of real power, that is, policy making. Now, this is a bit confusing, but this is the crux of the matter in China. The local unit of state power in China is the Revolutionary Committee. This is since the Cultural Revolution. The Revolutionary Committee would run this university, another SFU, another the transportation, another hospital. Every school has its own and so on. Every big office has its own and so on. But no matter what the ratio of male-female workers, the power of the Revolutionary Committee is consistently in the hands of males. Now, an imbalance could be expected at steel factories and in heavy industries where the majority of workers are men. For instance, at the Jinan lathe factory, there were 43 members of the Revolutionary Committee, five of whom were women. But at the New China Commune in Kwantung, where half the workers were women, there were 20 members on the Revolutionary Committee and only three were women, three representing the other 50% of the workers. In the Jinan pencil factory, half the workers were women, four on the Revolutionary Committee of 15 males. But conversely, at the Suzhou silk factory, where 80% of the workers were women, only seven were on the Revolutionary Committee of 19. And this balance was typical everywhere I went in a policy-making position. Now, there is a partial explanation, a rationale which the Chinese, with whom I discussed, made a great deal of, that the committees must comprise one-third cadres, one-third workers, and one-third members of the People's Liberation Army, the PLA. They must also be one-third young, one-third middle-aged, one-third old. And very, very few women fall into this category because women in the past have had very little opportunity to be politically involved or to be involved in the Chinese armed forces. And in this way, the facts of the past were offered to me to explain the reality of the present. But I thought, and think to this day, that this is an elitist approach. For the masses of workers in the past, as well as the peasants and the foot soldiers, also had limited political experience. They had not been told to wait, as the chairman of the Canton Revolutionary Committee, a male, told me they should. He used an expression that I heard time and time again in China. Women, he said, had to temper themselves. They had no experience. I protested that the workers, the peasants, the soldiers also had no experience. Well, he said, that may be true, but women are not really suited politically. Women must temper themselves. Now, I really felt that, like the Western counterparts, the system didn't make that much difference, even though one of the basic planks is equality for women. That the male ego is truly threatened, whether it's Chinese or Russian or Cuban or American or Canadian, by the concept of true equality. By having their entire set of traditional values challenged and changed by political upheavals, the Chinese men have made monumental strides towards equality. Now, I don't want to play this down. I'm not kicking them. We can't expect them to do a great back cultural black backflip overnight. We're talking about the realities. We're looking for solutions for ourselves. They have come a heck of a long way. They've made great steps towards equality, but at an emotional level, the system is still full of remnants of feudal thinking. For instance, if we look at the very, very current popular Chinese literature being printed by the Peking Press, we find that the majority of the heroes are all male. We have Cai Yongchang, who dies saving a trainload of Red Guards, Qin Sunhua, who drowns saving state property, Lu Tingchung, he dies saving children, Lai Feng, who's killed directing traffic. There are others who by far are just as widely read, and they're very popular folk heroes. Now, there are exceptions. That's very interesting because the Russian Soviets also used women in the first stages of the revolution. Of course, China is far beyond the first stages now, but the Russians used them at first. And much of the Russian literature in the 1930s, in the days of Galen and Borodin, was introduced into China as examples for the Chinese women to follow. But now that the revolution is consolidated, the heroes are almost all male. Where there are exceptions, where the women share glory equally with the men, there's a strong paternalistic streak. For instance, Ah Chen is a story of a revolutionary woman steel worker. But she's revolutionary and she's heroic only because the party secretary, a male, pushes her to these heights. Quote, "We've got to help her," he says. Quote, "Only by stealing her in difficulties, only by us making strict demands on her, will we be showing her true love," unquote. These stories are accepted unreservedly as revolutionary by both sexes, rather than for what they are. They're extremely well-disguised exercises in male chauvinism. I refrain from saying so, but when I suggested obliquely that male chauvinism still existed, I was told that I lacked understanding of the political system, that there cannot be women's liberation by itself, that men and women must be liberated together. Now, I agree with this, but with great, great reservations. This is an argument that we're hearing more and more within the women's liberation movement. It's becoming very, very fashionable to talk about people's liberation, as if women's liberation were some sort of ego trip, or as if it had already been accomplished and we can now move on to the next stage. Now, a lot of this feeling arises from the reality that within many of our groups within the movement, there is no progress, there has been no progress beyond that of personal therapy, sort of personal salvation, saving ourselves, being liberated, improving our own life, our own personal life, without any thought whatsoever, without any sensitivity to the true oppression that exists amongst the masses of the women who don't have our education, who'd be scared just shitless of even coming up to UBC. It is true also that the majority, it is a fact that the majority of us in the movement are better educated and that we're from the bourgeoisie. And that in a movement organized by women, focusing on the oppression of women, the bourgeoisie and the personal, very personal aspects of oppression tend to obscure the class oppression of both men and women. This tendency today, is to increasingly regard women's liberation as an incidental aspect of the primary class struggle. Now, I believe this attitude is incorrect and mistaken and potentially highly destructive to the movement. The women's movement is still in the formative stages, and if we, by discouraging a really revolutionary approach, by failing to really believe in ourselves, which has happened all along, which we have to fight against, is it real, this oppression? Am I imagining it? Am I exaggerating it? By setting up a Marxist-type dichotomy between bourgeois personal forms of oppression and real or material forms, a Marxist class analysis is substituted for for us, I'm not talking about revolutionary countries, is a much deeper understanding, a far more critical understanding, that there are for women two aspects of oppression, and that these aspects depend upon and reinforce one another. There is the class aspect, and just equally as valid, and the one we must work on is the aspect of our own liberation. Now, I would go so far. In the movement, we try and keep united, but as I said, there's this feeling that we're free to talk about people's liberation. I don't know. I think some of it's coming out of being psychically tired. Because it is really, really, it is. It's very tiring to fight day in and day out these attitudes, especially when you've been born and bred with them yourself. But I think that those who talk about people liberation as a replacement for women liberation are basically anti-feminist. For the so-called people's liberation makes it very possible to avoid a confrontation with the realities and the end results of male chauvinism and the closely related values of elitism and authoritarianism. What I'm suggesting is simply this. It is true that the capitalist system, being as it is, based on increased production for increased consumption, for increased profits, has turned the majority of women into little more than unhappy and often witless consumers. It is equally true that the system, if allowed to progress the way it's going, if not basically reconstructed, will similarly dehumanize and use men. I do not believe, however, that Marxism-Leninism offers a solution, an ultimate solution for us to the problem of equality between the sexes. Now, it is true that the women of these countries participate to a greater degree in government, in medicine, and in science than, say, they do in Canada. But I am optimistic enough to believe that we are on the verge of a similar degree, not this year, not next year, but we are getting there. If you look at the legislation that's gone through, we're on the verge of a similar type of participation. In fact, I think that we are going to push beyond the degree of participation in these countries. And I won't go into the reason. I think we will. We're starting late, but I think we're going to make up for it. It's going to happen for two reasons. One, because the class struggle is underway in this country, it is going to continue, but more important, the women's movement, working with but separate from the class struggle, is going to triumph because the truth is now out and it is authentic. We are a response to changing social conditions. We are not a fad or a fashion. But we're not going to triumph if we are talked into believing that the movement should concentrate only on real material forms, that is, the class struggle, and that we should thrust aside consciousness of so-called bourgeois personal and psychological forms of oppression. Of course, our consciousness is bourgeois, and of course, our concerns at the beginning are bourgeois. We have benefited from higher education. But we have also seen through the myth of equality and independence that the woman who works in a factory just might imagine that we have, that independence brings freedom, that wealth brings freedom and liberty and so on. We have pushed to the periphery of democracy. We're aware of, we can analyze male elitism from our own experience, from the fact that we've been able to push out to that democratic periphery and feel for ourselves, money and education regardless, the humiliating limitations imposed on us simply because we are female. As our level of female consciousness develops, as our analysis becomes sharper, through women's liberation, not people's liberation, so does our sensitivity to the overwhelming oppression of the lives of poorer women, of all women for that matter, rich or poor, but particularly for the poorer woman, particularly for the aged woman who gets, what is it, $2,700 a year in this country on an average as compared to, it's about $1,900 for the woman over 65 is the average income, because she can't participate in the Canada Pension Fund. If she does put her energies into raising the children in the family, she can't participate. If her husband dies, she doesn't get that pension. If he dies, she doesn't get it from the office. If she does stay at home, she faces a life of poverty. If she goes out and works, she can expect to get 45% of what the male earns on the national Canadian average. This aspect of psychological oppression, well, I'm just talking about material oppression, but to get back to the psychological oppression that makes women fearful of being who they are, that makes them unsure of their own judgment, unsure of their own capabilities. This psychological oppression is something of which males in the far left or the Marxist movements too often, for my comfort, to believe in, seem to be blithely unaware. I think that Stokely Carmichael spoke for many men in the movement when he said that the position of the women in the movement is prone. I'd like to read here something that really isn't very important in any sense, but it's rather interesting because it's the wife of a prominent English communist, Harold Beale, told this recently to the London Observer when they asked her what it's like to be married to a male revolutionary hero. Oh, she said, well, as soon as I had children, I stopped being political. I'm sure that most women who live in extremist political circles, unless they're single and unattached, become isolated against their will. The men expect them to provide an established bourgeois background to support them while they carry on their political activities in peace. They all have very progressive ideas about bringing up children, but they leave them to be looked after by their mothers. They support the male system of sharing labor. Office workers and intellectuals exchanging jobs with manual workers, but they leave everything to the commonplace and domestic to us. I don't think I've ever seen my husband clean a room. As a matter of fact, I'm even frightened to ask him to run across the room and get me 6 pounds of potatoes. It would seem such a trivial request to him. If I ask to borrow the car, he always has to contact Comrade so-and-so or attend an important political meeting. When he comes home with his friends, they talk politics and I serve the meal and take the plates away. But I'm not expected to say anything. The men all grumble at these gatherings that women don't attend the meetings, but it's not surprising that we become emotionally antagonistic to the whole thing. And then she said, he gives me a weekly allowance of £10, which has been the same for years and years. I'm not allowed any of the status symbols of middle class life, such as a car or a new sofa or a garden fence. He just says it's stupid, we don't need them. But still, he does expect me to provide him with a comfortable home.
Oh, I think that's funny. I think that to a very large extent is where it's at, and certainly this is something that those of us who are in the leftish movements in the States very well came to realize, that we ended up, just as if we were working for the Liberal Party, the Republican Party, we ended up making coffee and stuffing envelopes. And to summarize, I think the need for us to believe in ourselves and to be united as women, is greater now than ever before. Certainly from our own socialist government, we see mounting evidence in the last couple of weeks that male supremacy crosses all class and political lines. For instance, delegates at the recent NDP convention at the Bayshore voted overwhelmingly, as they're at the moment, with shouts of joy and great hurrah. They really believed it. When they voted for the Ministry of Women, they thought something had happened. But then, what happened on the Monday? Well, Premier Barrett says there'll be no such thing. Instead, he started talking about precisely what I'm talking about. That is people's liberation, which is a very slick way of him ignoring the inherent justices that are just rampant in this very province under his nose, but of which he has no sensitivity or limited sensitivity. Being a male and not having his consciousness raised in such things as unequal wages. For instance, the women in the fish cannery factories here, sitting side by side with the men. The men get $2.89 an hour. The women sitting next to them, doing the same thing, get $1.89 an hour. Unequal opportunities, sexist textbooks in the schools, and so on. All these things are just part of the scene here, but he says he can't see any reason for a Ministry of Women. The Minister of Labor, Bill King, a delegation of women went over to see him the other day about the two women from office assistance who filed a complaint with the Human Rights Commission that they were not getting the same wage as the man with whom they were working and they had better sales than he did. All they wanted was not more than he was getting, they just wanted equal pay. They were promptly fired. Then they were reinstated, but no, they weren't allowed to come to the office. When they came to the office, all the other women with a low level of political consciousness were wearing placards, bearing banners, asking them to leave immediately because they had been told by the managers of office assistance the profit-sharing scheme would not be paid out this year because all the money from it for the employers was going to employ lawyers to defeat these two women. And so consequently, they demonstrated against the two women when they came into the office for their job. They have not been given severance slips, so they cannot get unemployment insurance. And since October the 26th, have received no wages, although they've been reinstated. Nor they cannot get unemployment insurance. Bill King, the Minister of Labor, was asked about this. What was he going to do about the Human Rights Commission? To whom 486 complaints were filed in the last year and they acted on 26 of them. And he said nothing. He said, well, they were going to look into the subject of inequality for women. As a matter of fact, they were going to do a study on it. And they're going to go, he said it would be about a year and a half before they had any results. So we should face the facts that male chauvinism is a reality that crosses all political and all party lines and all political philosophies. So I just want to summarize. Let's not lose the movement now by talking about people's liberation. We're all for people. We're all for people's liberation. And the only way we can get it is to get a true woman's liberation, get these other basics fixed first. It's a slick gimmick by both Marxists and capitalists equally to avoid the realities of oppression by the male chauvinist. Whether the struggle is in a capitalist country or a communist country, the enemy is the same. The male chauvinist who will turn whatever system is at his disposal against the accomplishment of full equality. The struggle must be initiated, motivated, and supported by women and by those men who have proved their sincerity and justice by the fact of their daily lives. It doesn't matter whether the system is communist, socialist, or capitalist, the struggle is going to be the same. Liberation, no matter who's at the top, is not going to be handed down. It must be fought for and taken. And I thank you.